Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Amber Hollibaugh, interim director of the New York-based Queers for Economic Justice, on why marriage isn't the pot of gold at the end of the six-colored rainbow. And then at the bottom of the hour, the economic journalist Jeff Madrick on his new book, The Age of Greed, just out from Knopf. Before that, some words in the news. I've been involved in some internet polemics. Remember internet polemics before the Facebook like button made everyone so sweet and nice? I thought it might be worth recounting here. It all started when my friend, an occasional Behind the News guest, Corey Robin, a professor of political science at Brooklyn College, asked for comments on a piece by the liberal blogger Matthew Iglesias, a contribution to a debate hosted by The Atlantic magazine's website, on the single best thing we can do to spark job creation. The debate itself was a remarkable collection of tiny little ideas. Iglesias's contribution was that the Fed should adopt a higher inflation target, which, although not explicitly stated now, is probably around 2%. This suggestion is all wet. Raising the inflation target would imply that the Fed has been too tight, when in fact it's been anything but over the last several years. It's been pumping like crazy since the financial crisis broke out. This bout of easiness has set the loons aflame, leading them to fulminate about currency debasement and hyperinflation, when in fact it's done little but encourage commodity speculation. So we've seen commodity prices rise, but with no effect on general inflation, which is still very low, as you might expect with the economy flat on its back and the labor market in a stupor. Orthodox types, and I'm including Iglesias, who describes his political leanings as neoliberal on his Facebook profile page, usually prefer monetary to fiscal remedies. Why is that? It's because monetary policy operates through the financial markets and doesn't mess with labor or product markets or the class structure. A jobs program and other New Dealish stuff would mess with labor and product markets and the class structure. That's why it's mostly verboten to talk about jobs programs. The primary problem with the jobs program and with employment-boosting infrastructure projects is that they would put a floor under employment, making workers more confident and less likely to do what the boss says, and less dependent in general on private employers for a paycheck. It would increase the power of labor relative to capital. I'm not sure that Iglesias understands this explicitly, but it's undoubtedly part of the unexamined common sense of a mainstream pundit like him. Jobs programs and infrastructure investment are very potent economic tools. So aside from putting the unemployed to work, a compellingly humane goal in itself, and spiffing up our rotting physical environment, jobs programs and infrastructure investment would boost broad economic growth dramatically. But we can't do that because the yahoos don't like it. High-speed rail equals Europe equals fags, for example. And because jobs programs might lead the working class to develop an attitude, and we can't have that. Therefore, respectable people just don't suggest such things. There's also a strain of populist thought, prominent in U.S. political history, that embraces inflation and easy money as some sort of curative strategy. I don't agree. Easy money is really a cowardly substitute for redistribution. Over the long term, Milton Friedman was more or less right in saying that loose money can't change economic fundamentals. It can't spark much growth, it can't raise real wages, and it can't do much to improve our quality of life. It's mostly just froth. To spark growth, raise wages, and improve our quality of life, you need some serious spending, better labor laws, and stronger and more pervasive unions. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Amber Hollibaugh.
They don't know what's good. She had a daughter of veils.
That was some of Charlotte Says, a 1997 song from the Spanish indie band El Inquilino Comunista. Their name means the communist tenant, which is a nickname that Spanish women give their periods. Red, you know. My first guest is Amber Hollibaugh, interim executive director of Queers for Economic Justice. I admire Amber a lot, and it's wonderful to be able to interview her. She grew up in rural California, where she suffered from abuse and poverty, and then went on to become a major fighter for gay and lesbian rights and for sexual freedom. But all along, she's kept a vigorous class perspective in her work, as we'll hear. It's good to hear a skeptical voice amidst all the celebration of New York's legalization of same-sex marriage. Before we listen, though, I should say that I am married. I like being married. And I think it's wonderful that my home state, the site of Stonewall, after all, has finally legalized same-sex marriage. But amidst all the celebration, it's important to recognize the limits of that victory. For that, we now turn to Amber Hollibaugh. Welcome, Amber. A lot of people in the LGBTQ lobbying community have been very pleased by New York State's passage of a same-sex marriage law. You and your colleagues at QAJ are not quite as excited as the rest. What are your reservations?
We understand that it is an important legislative victory. It was a discriminatory clause, and we are, you know, we're not foolish. We understand that it's not okay to discriminate against LGBT people as different than anybody else. But that being said, our critique is really of whether marriage and marriage equality is a good idea, and whether the way that you want to couple the need for benefits, security rights, survivorships are the best way to actually do it by marriage equality, or whether you actually need to think about different configurations of family and relationships and kinship systems, and separate things like health care and Social Security from marriage. And so QEJ has done something, been a part of something called the Beyond Same-Sex Marriage Statement, which is an attempt to re-envision what we're talking about concretely. What kind of configurations of family and relationships do we mean? What kinds of issues do we think are critical? And what does it mean for benefits to come through a primary relationship like marriage, and what it means for everybody else that either can't get married, doesn't want to get married, or doesn't have a partner, and so it's irrelevant. And so QEJ has been quite critical of making LGBT marriage equality, or LG marriage equality, a primary focus of the political agenda of LGBT rights.
I think somebody went through and counted at some point there were like 12 or 1300 specific rights that marriage confers upon people. What are some ways that we could structure things so that marriage was not the key to those 12 or 1300 shared things?
This is a particularly interesting moment, Doug, to be asking those questions, because many of the things that people hope to get through marriage equality are now being threatened at this exact moment. In the fight around issues like Social Security, Medicaid, many of those kinds of things, you know, you might want to access those things as a married couple, but if those things disappeared, it's not quite clear what you're going to get for being married. If all the social safety net programs that give you benefits are shredded, then marriage doesn't give you access. And I think what we're trying to say is that the things that people need, they need as individuals. And the needs for recognition of different kinds of families need to then be framed in that way, so that people that are in long-term relationships, for instance, two lesbians raising a child with a gay man, would be recognized as a legitimate family as much as any same-sex partner or opposite-sex partner would be. That there are a lot of different kinds of configurations in communities that need to be recognized if you're giving privileges through those recognitions, and marriage is simply one more form of relationship and shouldn't rise above all others. People really do need support for their families, for raising kids, for taking care of elders in their community, in their family, in their kinship systems. And marriage is a very particular, limited possibility for a very particular and limited group of people.
The opponents of same-sex marriage always said that it was a slippery slope, and that it was going to lead to recognition of all kinds of other partnerships other than just two men or two women. But it sounds like you're out there lubricating this.
That's exactly slope. I am. Absolutely, I am. I'm sure that the argument about slippery slope is, but it's the argument always around, I think, the inclusion of minority populations in majority cultures. Oh my God, if you start to recognize this, then you have to recognize this, 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 and this at the same time. It's all going to end in chaos, and the whole culture is going to collapse. That is the kind of argument that's made, and you just have to really take it on and say, how's America living in family and kinship? The monogamous two-adult heterosexuals with 2.5 kids is not working and is not the demographic reality for most Americans, period. Straight or gay, however you can understand yourself and your relationships, that's not how most people live. They live in much more complicated kinds of relationships and in very different kinds of communities. So what's ironic to me often in the marriage recognition fight for LGBT rights after its civil rights issue is, majority of people are running out the door of marriage and we're trying to run in. And I think, really? Do we really want to do this? Is this how we want rights? And that's the question that I think is the really critical question. It's one thing to want to be married to someone and have that recognized in a community. It's another to need health insurance and have to find somebody to get married to in order to be able to survive or deal with a healthcare crisis or a housing crisis or an education crisis. It's ridiculous that marriage is the way you access those benefits.
What's interesting that in the social democracies of Northwestern Europe, most benefits are conferred to people, not via families or through their marital status, but that's not the way we do things here.
No, and that's the point. I mean, really, there needs to be a separation so each individual has the capacity to access the resources that allow them to live at a base level with the things they need, health insurance, education, housing, etc. And so marriage is no answer for how you need to organize resource for each of the people in the country that you're talking about. We all live very differently configured kinds of lives. If only one thing is privileged as the way you can access benefits, then people desperately use that as an institution to get there. But it's not a good form. It's just a question of whether or not you're going to make an argument that that's why you want to get married.
Now let's step back a bit. I mean, it's interesting that the struggle for gay and lesbian rights, at least in the mainstream lobbying world, has focused in the last few years on getting into the military and getting married. How did we get to this position? How did this marriage struggle get, the centrality of marriage thing begin?
Oh, my God. I often find it ironic that I end up in a conversation about marriage and the military as the two things that are articulated as the way that that LGBT people will gain equality. And I think, did I ever mean this? Did I ever once not have a critique of the military and not have a critique of marriage? But I think what happened, this is my sense of it, is that as LGBT movements became more visible and more able to advocate for legislative resolutions, for non-discrimination, for a whole range of other things. And I think a lot of that happened concurrently with the AIDS crisis and the need to really have government support. You can't deal with an epidemic, in your house. That people began to see the opportunity for gaining legislative recognition of partnerships, and as well, we began to formally try to create families through adoption and different ways of kind of different ways to create families and biological kids. And people wanted protection in those creations of family and felt enormously vulnerable that children could be taken away in same-sex partnerships, that the ways that we actually build community could really be threatened, and we were very vulnerable if we were attacked around the way that we were creating kinship and family and children. And so marriage, I think, originally started in my memory as a way to try and protect people who were creating more traditional kinds of extended family structures. Now, it's not like LGBT people didn't have kids before the marriage fight, and it's not as though people didn't want recognition of or safety in that. But as we became more public, the fight for how to protect the ways that we were building family became much more an urgent issue. If it was two lesbians and a gay man, would that child be considered only the child of the biological mother? If it was adoption, could you only adopt as a single parent and not have your relationship be visible in the adoption process? Second parent adoption, all those kinds of issues became really critical. I think it fueled the fight for marriage recognition as part of a strategy to try and protect our relationships from the way that we were often portrayed and the way that we often were targeted by the right. It led to a whole series of other things, I think, but my sense is that that made it more urgent than it had ever been.
I'm speaking with Amber Hollibaugh, who is Interim Executive Director of Queers for Economic Justice. I think Dan Savage said that same-sex marriage is going to change the institution of marriage by opening it up and queering it, in some sense. Now, I'm wondering about that. I mean, very often the long march through the institutions ends up changing the marchers more than the institutions.
Exactly. I think that's the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life. And I've often had that told to me by folks who otherwise often have progressive or more radical kinds of critiques of social institutions. Most people don't say to me that we're going to somehow change military institutions by being now allowed to serve in them. Nobody says the U.S. military is going to have a different agenda because it has lesbian and gay people in service.
More brunches, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I can only hope. But the idea that you can change a fundamentally flawed institution, which has been in place in the way that it's been in place for centuries, is, to me, a disingenuous kind of conversation. We're not changing it. I mean, people can decide to live within the institution of marriage and do it any way they want to once they're married. But we're not going to change the institution. The institution, I think, is a very particular kind of institution, and it was established to create property rights so that men controlled the females they married and the children that those females birthed. That was what it was. It was a contract to be able to control the offspring that came from a union between a man and a woman. It's hard to think that it somehow being queer within that is going to change it. That's still its purpose, is to organize families and resources and recognition in a very particular way. And so what if it's same-sex? Are you the same as a straight person in a same-sex marriage? Frankly, I think you are, because I think it's an argument about being normal. And if you don't want to be normal, if you don't think the value of relationships is to be normal, like everybody that came before you that was heterosexual, then marriage is probably not a really good venue to try and think through a vision for the future.
Now, doesn't this fight expose some fissures within the gay community in that
Yep.
maybe there are many who just want to be normal? It might even be Republican if the Republicans weren't such homophobes.
Weren't so homophobic. homophobic themselves. Yeah, I think that's true. I think that they, I mean, I think marriage is only one reflection of a real going in two directions. One direction is a direction for equality, for being regular people at a, like, to be normal people at an unequal table. So, okay, you've never been let into this table, into this room, now you want to be let in. The fact that the table itself is absolutely unfair to huge numbers of people doesn't matter. You want to be at it. Or you want to change the table. That's a really different way of thinking about it. And marriage does not give you freedom. It does not give you liberation. It gives you access to a particular set of values and resources for a very particular set of people that can access it. And that's all it does. And if you want to be that person, then I'm sure it's very important. Part of the interesting fight to me has been, I think that LGBT people have really, really been punished for loving each other. And part of what I think also fuels the kind of river underneath marriage equality is the bitterness that people have for not being seen legitimately as people who loved each other and who loved and valued the relationships they were in. And it's ended up being a fuel for the marriage fight instead of a fuel for the recognition of queer people in the kind of relationships we have, whether they're two-person, three-person, a communal family, whole ranges of way that people love each other and form community. That, I think, is something that can never be reflected in marriage. Marriage would have never been an answer during the HIV crisis, ever. We had non-traditional families because everybody was dying, and everyone had to step in to care for, to manage, to create unity around the vulnerability of a person who was sick. And we called it family, and it wasn't seen as something of value. But it's something I feel very proud about, and marriage never captured that and would never have been a safety net that would have given us capacity to deal with an epidemic.
We're old enough to remember, I'm sorry to say, that when gay liberation first emerged, it emerged as part of a radical upsurge of the 60s, as part of a project of social transformation, and specifically with an interest in changing the way society thought about sexuality and sexual identity. What's happened to that?
You know, I think that that is still an important part of the underground, the more underground part of the LGBTQ movement. Again, I think, Doug, we're talking about the kind of, I don't know, the moving in two very different directions between those who want kind of equality and legislative resolution and those who have a different vision and hope that that vision is fueled and really articulated through sexual orientation, gender identity, and the possibility for an unimagined set of relationships, desires, erotic behaviors, capacity that really are not straight, monogamous, and married. And Stonewall and all the fights that came out of the early gay liberation, I think, really were embedded in a vision of smashing heterosexuality, that was what often people talked about, of really shifting the way that all people understood what was possible in their sexual and their erotic lives, what was possible in their community lives, in their kinship lives. That's really what the feminist movement, when it was women's liberation, I mean, that was where the questioning of marriage really began. It didn't, you know, it was really fueled by a feminist critique of marriage as an institution that had been very, very damaging for women and had controlled and devalued women and women's work. That was an early conversation, and that's, to me, what's so ironic about how gay marriage is presented, as though it's this liberatory and enormously valuable set of possibilities for gay and lesbian people, instead of it being something that's understood as something that's at best a civil rights struggle, a legislative fight around discrimination rather than a set of values that capture what we hope queer life could mean for us and for all people.
And an enormous amount of resources, human and financial, have been taken up for in this marriage fight. And I presume now that we've got, what, 6 states, there are 44 more to go. So it's just going to keep going, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's one of the things that I think has been the most troubling about it. You can have an internal struggle in a movement around priorities. But where a movement is really able to move has an enormous amount to do with its funding stream about what is considered a priority. If inclusion in the military and inclusion in the institution of marriage are how the LGBT movement critique their priorities, then all the other work, the social justice work that I think was embedded in early gay liberation, the transformative struggle for the way that LGBT and Q identities would be seen in the context of change disappears. And suddenly your funding streams in the LGBT movement are driven around where you can get money. And the money only comes through two or three issues. And if you're not prioritizing those issues or they're not your vision, you're out of the funding stream.
Who are those funders, by the way?
Well, you know, they've been everything from the Gill Foundation, Arcus, Astraea not so much, Ford a little bit, but they've also been driven a great deal not by foundations but by private donors. And often the folks that have been really willing to drop big amounts of money who are wealthy LGBT people have cared especially around marriage, because it was one of the few rights that even though they had many resources, they didn't have access to. So it's helped build a base of funders. So it didn't necessarily have to rely simply on traditional liberal foundation support to fund that part of the movement.
And of course, these people are not going to fund a social justice movement that may end up taking away some of their money.
No. I mean, really, are they going to fund the work of a place like QEJ or the Audre Lorde Project or FIERCE or Sylvia Rivera Law Project that works in low-income communities and is working very hard to say that the majority of LGBTQ people have no access to resources, are often poor or working class? Probably not. It was the same fight you saw develop in the AIDS movement. It's a fight about class and about how you prioritize your vision. And if your vision is to change the entire conversation about what world you want to live your queer identity in, then you're in a very different conversation than whether you think everything's hunky-dory, but you got left out of a couple of things. That's a very different conversation. If you think capitalism is a fabulous system and fine with you and you just want it to be more inclusive of lesbian and gay people, that's one set of agendas. If you really, really have a critique of the way that issues like poverty and income position you to target you in a very, very vulnerable way as a queer person, then you might have a different agenda.
Which is a perfect segue for a little ad for QEJ, since we're just about out of time.
What are you all about? What do you do?
We are one of the few LGBT organizations that prioritize economic justice through sexual and gender liberation thinking. And that means, for example, we do a great deal of work with LGBTQ people in the shelters. We do a lot of work around beyond same-sex marriage organizing, around family organization, around building a queer left, and around work that we think begins to articulate the impact, for example, of the recession on LGBT people, the way that poverty and underemployment and being a queer worker have an enormous impact on the way you can live a queer identity. We try and actually have a vision for the way that economics shapes the lived reality of queer identity. If you're trying to sleep with somebody and you have an apartment, it's a really different question than if you're homeless or you're poor. Same sex, different positioning, different set of priorities.
That was Amber Hollibaugh, Interim Executive Director of Queerists for Economic Justice. For more on the issue, check out the website beyondmarriage.org. That's one word, beyondmarriage.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Jeff Madrick. That was some of the third movement of Béla Bartók's Piano Sonata, performed by Martha Argerich. My next guest is Jeff Madrick, one of the smartest economic journalists around. His new book is called Age of Greed, and it's an excellent review of the economic history of the last four decades or so. If you'd like a good history of how we got to the present mess, you could do no better than his book, The Age of Greed, just out from Knopf. Jeff Madrick. Welcome, Jeff. We've seen a lot of histories of the economic crisis that begin sometime like 3 or 4 years ago, but you start back in the 1970s, which is a pretty good place to start to look at the roots of our present economic morass. You open with a little sketch of a fellow named Lewis Euler, who is extremely obscure today, but who is he? What role did he play in history?
Well, I open with him because I think he represented something. A lot of people don't understand what was going on. A lot of us think everybody loved the New Deal and FDR. And there wasn't any real fallout from that period. But in fact, lots of people hated the New Deal during the New Deal and hated FDR. Lou Euler was the son of one of those FDR haters. Went to Yale College, went to Bolt Law School, smart guy. Became a right-wing political operator for people like Rousselot, a John Birch member. But he represented for me this angry current, and this was the 1950s, that existed in America that hadn't really come to light in most of the establishment press, most of the establishment media. Bill Buckley was rising in that period, but people didn't fully understand how strong an underpinning of support there was for what I would have considered then and still do extreme right-wing anti-government views. And Euler eventually got involved with Ronald Reagan, who, as governor of California after his John Rousselot days. John Rousselot was the only member of Congress who was a member of the John Birch Society, I believe. And Euler brought Reagan an idea, let's try to get the California people to support an amendment to their state constitution to cut state income taxes. Euler would say these things, and we now hear them all over the place, but they were somewhat unheard of then. The founding fathers never believed in progressive income taxes. It was not in our constitution. Now we hear this kind of drumbeat all the time. But Euler convinced Reagan to propose something called Proposition 1. Reagan, remember, was a moderately successful governor because every once in a while he would compromise pragmatically with the Democrats. And he was worried he wasn't leaving a conservative enough legacy to launch a campaign for the presidency. So he really liked this idea. Well, what happened? Reagan supported it and campaigned for it vigorously. Euler basically wrote it. Milton Friedman had a heart attack then, but nevertheless got out of his bed and campaigned for it as well as a number of conservatives who have since become famous. And guess what the California people did in early 1973? They said, no, we don't want to cut our state income taxes. We think it's foolish. By something like a 54-55% majority, they voted Proposition 1 down. That, to me, suggests that America was still a progressive nation at that point, but it would change rapidly.
Well, and just before that, that was the end of the Nixon administration, pretty much. But you know, the Nixon administration sort of embodied both the liberal and conservative aspects of American politics all at one time. And we see certainly a lot of root of today's right-wing politics in the Nixon years, but also he was something of a liberal, or at least, as you put it, you quote somebody saying he was the last president who was afraid, it was Nader, right, who said he was the last president who was afraid of liberals.
Yeah, I think Nader hit it on the head. We were still a liberal nation. Nixon was very sensitive to the political winds, as we know, and he created lots of agencies that conservatives have since come to hate, the Environmental Protection Agency, OSHA, while also trying to develop that Southern strategy to some degree and also exploiting racial hatreds and so forth. He was arguably our last liberal president because he created a lot of new and, in fact, useful regulatory agencies, the Consumer Product Safety Agency and so on. Kind of interesting, but it wasn't because he was necessarily liberal in his heart and soul, but he read the political messages, and they were still, America was still a progressive nation in those years, or a moderately progressive nation.
And he did something which outraged me in my days as a right-winger. He imposed wage and price controls.
The inflation seemed to be getting out of hand. Nixon did not inherit an easy agenda. There's all this talk these days about how Obama has the worst agenda. Almost every president has taken on a very difficult agenda. Nixon took office and a recession descended on us, and he had to deal with Vietnam War and a rising trade deficit and all that kind of thing. It was not easy. But yeah, he imposed those wage price controls to keep inflation down, which no Democrat probably could have done, although it's interesting that Paul Volcker was the leading staff guy who put that through. Volcker was always a Democratic government official, but they placed that on there, but the kicker was they put the lid on prices and wages and then stepped on the throttle to get the economy moving while they had this lid on wages in late 71 and early 72, so he wouldn't lose the 72 election. Figured we can really step on the gas here without getting inflation because we've got this lid on. Well, once he took that lid on, inflation was, for many, many years thereafter, uncontrollable. And that part of the history is not well told and not emphasized. Everybody blames Johnson for inflation because he didn't raise taxes to pay for guns and butter, quote unquote, in 1967. But in fact, Nixon had as much or more to do with the terrible inflation that overtook us in the mid-1970s. And that's what changed America. That, in my view, is what turned Americans conservative. It wasn't only that. There was a lot of anti-government feeling over lots of issues, like Watergate, like being lied to about the Vietnam War. But I think that was, in the end, the catalyst.
And although the country was more or less liberal in its political thinking in the early 70s, by the end of the decade that had changed. California went from rejecting Prop 1 to accepting Prop 13. What happened in the intervening years?
Well, that was the Great Inflation. The Great Inflation combined with the Great Unemployment. And Americans panicked, policymakers panicked, above all Democrats, with a capital D, the Democrats in office panicked. They did not know how to deal with the set of circumstances. But it became easy to blame government for all of this. Deficit, the federal budget was in deficit. People argued the government was way too big. We just went through the Great Society, and then Nixon added his agencies and so forth. Government became the easy pincushion of politicians, of pundits, and especially gave rise to Milton Friedman's ideas. Friedman is, and I have a chapter on him in Age of Greed that I think is unlike any other anywhere. Friedman started becoming a political conservative somewhere in the late 1940s and early 50s, and had been plowing this territory with very little success. But the inflation and unemployment suddenly seemed to give his theories, which are highly oversimplified, give them credibility, because he said inflation was a function of the government, was caused by government. That combination of events turned America, and soon, of course, business organized itself to also produce new megaphones to tell America it was government's fault. We need lower taxes, less government, and all our problems would be solved. That five-year stretch, in 1978, when Proposition 13 was overwhelmingly supported by the Californians, the cut in property taxes, it was the beginning of a nationwide tax revolt. It wasn't only in California. Similar measures were passed in other states, and of course, the famed Kemp-Roth bill, the proposal by Jack Kemp and William Roth, a senator from Delaware, to cut income taxes by 30%, was gaining adherence in 1978, and indeed scared Jimmy Carter, who also then proposed some tax cuts. And Reagan took up that Kemp-Roth bill and indeed got it passed.
I'm speaking with Jeff Madrick, author of The Age of Greed, just out from Knopf. You you organize your book around a multiple number of personalities who sort of gave us the modern era, and one of the important early figures, and we've been talking mostly about politics, but one of the important early figures was Walter Wriston, who was in the business of revolutionizing finance. Tell us how Wriston changed the landscape.
Well, Wriston is another one of these guys whose father hated Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but his father was a very well-known historian and intellectual who eventually became president of Brown. Wriston really didn't want to go into business, but he didn't want to go into academia. He was a bright guy, but he was a government hater. He was a talented guy. He rose rapidly at First National City Bank, as it was called. One of his first clients was Aristotle Onassis, the flamboyant oil tanker man who eventually married Jackie Kennedy. And Wriston started undermining New Deal regulations, one of the most important of which was Regulation Q. It put a top on the amount of interest banks could pay savers. Now, you might say, that doesn't make any sense. Why should there be a top on a cap on interest? Well, even Adam Smith in 1776 argued financial institutions shouldn't be allowed to pay any interest they want to their depositors, because then they'd go out and chase speculative investments, and the banking system could unwind. Well, Smith was darn right, and John Maynard Keynes said similar things. But Wriston was very clever about getting around it. One thing he did was establish, to give you an idea of how bold he was, and he was really the pioneer of financial deregulation from the business side. He wanted to get around the Regulation Q interest rate cap. His staff thought of an idea. Let's issue CDs in the amount, I think it was $100,000, but it might have been less back then, for wealthy people or big corporations, and make them negotiable, in other words, tradable at a market like stocks or bonds. And that way these companies could buy them, but it would be like cash. It wouldn't be like a three-month, it would be called a three-month CD, but they could get out of it right away for cash. The problem was somebody had to underwrite that secondary market, as it was called. Wriston and his guys went to the Discount Corporation, it was called that. And the Discount Corporation said, sure, we'll underwrite it, but we need financing. You have to give us $10 million. Well, in effect, he was underwriting his own. He decided he would do it. He was underwriting his own bond offerings, which probably was not allowable under Glass-Steagall. And his lawyer said, we got to go ask the Fed whether he could do this. And this was the genius or the evil of Walter Wriston, depending on which side of the argument you were on. He said, let's not go to the Fed. Let's just do it and let them stop us. And it worked. They did not stop him. And he did quite a few things just like that, undermine Regulation Q. His bank got more and more money. And I guess the most notorious thing he did was start lending those petrodollars that the Arab countries got when they raised the oil price. That's one of the big things, of course, that happened in the mid-1970s to cause inflation. The Arabs got all this all these dollars, what were they going to do with it? Riston was very well connected with the Saudi Empire, the Saudi nation, and he said, give it to me, I'm going to lend it out. Let's not wait for government. Some, like Paul Volcker, and even some Ford administration people thought, we need some kind of quasi-government organization or ad hoc agreement to channel this money in a useful way. Riston worked so rapidly to lend this money to South America mostly and some African nations, companies and nations, that there was no chance to set up a government partnership to do this. And almost all those loans went bad by the 1980s. Almost all of them. But Citibank made a fortune on them because they got $2 for every $100 of loans they gave. He knew how to make money. And that, in a way, defined Wall Street for the next 30 to 40 years.
Well, yeah, Riston certainly hated government, but the government bailed him out, what, after the Penn Central crisis in the early 70s. He got bailed out again with the Latin debt crisis of the 80s. He got bailed out again in the early 90s, and more recently became a ward of the state after
the recent
Citigroup,
financial crisis.
Of course, is the successor to Riston. Sandy Weill, it was John Reed, direct successor, merged with Sandy Weill. Sandy Weill effectively got rid of John Reed. And needed big bailouts, you know, not only, you know, but that's, you know, exactly the point. Here was this great ideologue who hated government until he really needed government. And you got the bailouts exactly right. He got bailed out time and again when he needed it. But, of course, it was different for him. He hated the bailouts of Chrysler, of Continental Illinois, but when it came to his own needs, well, that was special. That was different.
And speaking of another figure who shaped our current reality is Alan Greenspan, and your chapter subheading for him is ideologue. Greenspan goes way back in this story, right?
Yeah, well, Greenspan, of course, was around for Richard Nixon, actually. He did not like Nixon and did not want to work with him, but he eventually became chief economist under Ford, head of the CEA. He was a Wall Street economist, and there again is a New Deal story. I love the New Deal connection because his dad was, his natural father was a great New Dealer who actually wrote a book praising FDR and the New Deal. But his natural father was a failed businessman and probably left his mom and may have been a scoundrel for all we know. But Nixon's uncle, his mom's brother, was a conservative, successful businessman. Not Nixon, not Greenspan. And I think Greenspan began to really see him as a father figure. He influenced him. In any case, he really was a disciple of Ayn Rand, who was from the Soviet Union, hated anything that smacked of government, was a brilliantly talented purple prose fiction writer, whose books were, and quite an extraordinary person, but also one of the great simple-minded ideologies of all time. Greenspan was a member of the inner circle of her group, and he maintained that ideology. People were wary of him. Bill Bradley, in 86, was wary because in 87 he took over for Volcker as chairman of the Fed. Bradley was wary of his ideology, and Greenspan basically said he would submerge that ideology, that economy, you know, the science of economics is what he would be his guiding light. But in fact, he didn't. He refused to regulate. He refused to establish new regulations as markets changed over this period. He argued that speculation created stability, not instability. He argued that competition would lead bankers to do the right thing and not to create excesses. He was wrong on every one of those counts. And even when he was given all kinds of credit for reducing interest rates in the late 1990s, he kept talking about a new economy. He really made some of those most important moves, reducing interest rates, because he was scared markets weren't going to collapse after the Asian crises and the Russian crises in the late 1990s. So even what people think he did well is subject to skepticism. But by and large, if there's one person to choose who created this extraordinary calamity, it was Greenspan, because he had the power and the authority to demand more capital at the banks, to stop the fraudulent mortgage writing by these mortgage brokers throughout the nation. He had the influence to demand the regulation of derivatives, which were basically traded in secret. It's quite a story, and people still put him on the front page when he makes a comment, such as the state of our brave media.
Now, a couple of other figures who helped shape this, the present we're still living in, were the lawyer Joe Flom and the banker Michael Milken. What were their contributions to human progress?
Well, markets changed markedly in the 1970s when the economy collapsed. When I was in school, people thought stocks would just keep going up forever. Well, they stopped going up. And in its place, there were two things that occurred to take its place, so to speak. One were all these derivatives I'm talking about, ways to buy interest, to buy bonds and commodities and even stock market averages for very little money down. That enabled you to do all kinds of interesting, risky, and hedging strategies. But the other thing that occurred was stock prices were so low that it became very provocative to just buy a company instead of making investments. And Joe Flom was the great, a brilliant lawyer, was the great leader in that marketplace. And it soon led to hostile takeovers, which were completely unusual when done by established big companies. And the takeover mentality, this idea that you buy a company, take it over, cut costs, you take it over usually by borrowing money, and then cut costs, usually labor costs, often R&D, in order to pay the new debt service because you borrowed so much money to take it off. That dominated a lot of managerial ideas in the beginning in the 1970s, but especially in the 1980s. All those leverage buyouts were way too much debt was taken on, and labor, by and large, got kicked in the butt time and again as a consequence of that. The best data on that is that the mergers did not work. The combinations of companies usually made no sense. But more important, Wall Street, which was always getting a nice piece of the action, an outrageously large piece of the action as these deals got very big, Wall Street provoked ever higher bidding contests, and these companies would pay absurd prices after a while for the takeover targets. Well, into that fit Michael Milken, who created junk bonds. He realized, you know, we can't raise stock equity, so let's borrow money in this junk bond market, even if you're not a first-rate company. Sometimes that was effective. Sometimes it worked to finance worthy companies, but not very often. And ultimately, the junk bond financing became the source of financing for the takeover deals and the leverage buyouts. What a lot of people, what I think I talk about in my book, that a number of analysts and Mike Milken misunderstood was Milken went down because he was implicated in the Ivan Boesky scandal, insider trading by this notorious risk arbitrageur. But Milken would have gone down anyway because he was making the loans he were making were riskier and riskier as he went along. A lot less in coverage of a debt service, in other words, by cash flow. And he would have gone down anyway as the junk market did indeed go down. And I guess it was 1989, but people said if Milken was there, it would have been okay. No way. That's just nonsense. His reputation was almost saved because he went out before the markets themselves in his bad and very greedy decision-making brought him down. He was the buyer, the seller, and the middleman in the junk bond market, basically. He controlled the buyers, he controlled the sellers, and he took a piece in the middle, and sometimes secretly.
Now, I spent most of our time talking about the prehistory of the recent crisis. There's a lot of people have gone over what led to the immediate financial crisis we've been through, but not much of the prehistory. But I do want to conclude by asking about the present and the future. I mean, when we entered this financial crisis, I thought it might lead to some sort of rethink of the whole kind of strategy of economic management we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. It hasn't done that, has it? We're still really in the grip of that kind of thinking, aren't we?
Yeah, it's one of the great disappointments of your time and my time. I think that we turned momentarily in our minds. We knew we had to control Wall Street. We knew government needed a bigger presence. We knew we needed a stimulus. And we seem to reverted almost to Friedman-like economics. I think part of that is because we don't have a strong leader in President Obama. You know, FDR wasn't perfect. Sometimes we misremember him, to cite a word that's now currently used. But and indeed, even in the 1930s, a lot of progressives were angry at Roosevelt for not being progressive enough. But he was a tough customer when he fought those battles, and he fought some very hard battles, and he called his opposition what they were. He wasn't always trying to compromise and make amends and play nice. And we really needed a comparable leader now. Americans don't exactly know enough economics to judge what appropriate strategy should be. They need people to tell them that. And when the argument is dominated by a right and center, and a center that's really right of center, and a media that's has almost no independent mindedness, I think the web presence is changing that to some degree, but not rapidly enough. I think we really have not re-regulated Wall Street properly. Austerity economics is one of the great follies of our time, to be cutting government spending at a point when we are not creating any jobs and wages are not rising is quite extraordinary. It'll be looked at as an extraordinary time in history and maybe a very sad one.
That was Jeff Madrick, author of The Age of Greed, just out from Knopf. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Another song from El Inquilino Comunista, this one, Suki, from 1993. Till next week, bye.